We've gotten quite far in terms of mental health awareness and treatment today. We know a lot more about the causes of things like depression and anxiety, and have developed very effective treatment methods like cognitive behavioral therapy and other forms of medication, for example. But what if I told you that there was a Persian Muslim scholar and philosopher who seemed to have figured out some of these things almost 1,000 years before the rest of us did? A man whose writings appear so ahead of their time that he definitely deserves to be more widely considered in the history of medicine and health. Well, such a person actually existed, and today we're going to talk about him. Abu Zayd al-Belkhi was a polymath and brilliant scholar who lived between the 9th to early 10th century in the middle of what has sometimes been called the Golden Age of Islam, when the Abbasid Caliphate was at the height of its power. He was born around 850 in the region of Belkh, which is in modern Afghanistan, and spent much of his life here. Sadly, we don't know all that much about his life outside of a few mentions in later biographical sources, but a few details have emerged. He was always a curious and intelligent man who became involved in studying and mastering a number of different fields, from geography, which is maybe what he was most famous for in his own day. He even spearheaded a kind of Belkhi school of geography and, I think, map making. So that was his like main claim to fame at that time. But also things like medicine, Arabic grammar, philosophy more broadly, Islamic theology, literature and poetry, mathematics, astronomy and astrology, and much, much else. He's said to have composed over 60 works on a variety of different topics and was famed for his great eloquence. At some point, he seems to have traveled to Baghdad, the intellectual center of the Islamic world at that time, and studied with the great Arab Muslim philosopher Al-Kindi, who would probably have taught him many of the philosophical topics that he himself would come to master. Eventually, though, he returned home to Belkh and worked there as a scribe while composing many of his philosophical works. Generally, Abu Zayd is described in the very few biographical accounts that we have that he was quite reserved and shy, right? He didn't hang out with people and socialize that much, but sort of kept to himself, which might be one of the reasons why we know so little about his life, since he wasn't out and about and meeting people that much. But also maybe, at least I would argue, maybe one of the reasons that he knows or seems to have such a nuanced and good understanding of certain mental health and internal kind of issues that people might be afflicted with. And it's maybe quite likely that he, just like most of us, also experienced these mental states himself. And that is indeed what we're going to focus on today. There is one work of his that is especially fascinating for our subject, a book entitled Masalih al-Abdan wal-Anfus, Sustenance for the Body and the Soul. It is, as the title suggests, a work on medicine, written in the 9th century, but it is one that is amazingly ahead of its time. The work is divided into two parts, corresponding to the two parts of the title. Part 1, on the sustenance of the body, and thus primarily deals with physical medicine in a more classical sense. This is by far the largest part of the work, and while, of course, interesting from a historical perspective, it is based very firmly in the Galenic Greek medicine that was the standard at that time, but which today we know is just completely wrong and very outdated. And so that first part maybe is not that helpful for someone studying or trying to get into medicine today, even though, of course, there are parts of it that are still relevant, especially parts like when he discusses preventative things, like how to prevent becoming sick, for example. So like adjusting your diet or exercising, you know, these kinds of things, which is always relevant. This was, of course, a time when the Islamic world was intellectually very vibrant, which is not to say that there have been times when it wasn't, but still, this is famously a very vibrant intellectual time and place, and where influence was taken from old Greek, Indian, and Persian writings. through the translation movement, so-called, spearheaded by al-Balkhi's teacher al-Kindi, medical and philosophical works were translated from Greek, often via Syriac, into Arabic and incorporated into the Islamic framework. Al-Balkhi, of course, is placed right in the middle of this and represents it to some degree. But it is in the second and much shorter part of the work that things get really interesting. This is the part that is dedicated to the sustenance of the soul, or what we today would refer to as mental health or psychological health. Of course, talking about mental health as such wasn't anything new per se, but the way that he dedicates a section exclusively to it in this way, how he connects it with physical health, and the actual descriptions and advice he gives was quite unheard of at that time and is, again, way ahead of his time. And he seems to have been kind of aware of this himself, as he writes in the introduction that, quote, "As for our section on the sustenance of the soul, we do not know of anyone before us that has written on the subject and explained its contents according to the needs of the reader." And he also says, "This discussion is not generally mentioned by physicians nor documented in their written books on medicine, the sustenance of the body, and treatments of its physical ailments. This is because it's a subject not within their professional interest, and because the treatment of psychological symptoms does not match the remedies they give to patients, such as bloodletting, medicine, and other similar treatments. However, even if they do not take psychological treatment into consideration, and their habitual ways have led to their ignoring it, the approach of adding means for sustenance of souls to the sustenance of bodies is an appropriate, correct one. Indeed, it is a much-needed therapeutic approach which can be beneficial due to the interaction between the workings of the soul with those of the body. Man's stamina is a combination of both his body and soul, and one cannot imagine that he can exist without this dual combination which causes him to act as a human being. Their combination gives to man his ability to respond to threatening issues and painful symptoms." Already in this quote, we can see how he significantly connects the health of the soul with the health of the body, arguing that if the body is ill, then a person will sometimes lose much of their mental functions and ability as well. And that the opposite is true as well, that if one is suffering mentally, then that will prevent us from enjoying bodily pleasures and enjoyments and cause things like fatigue and maybe even sickness, physical sickness. This might be obvious today for us, but it certainly wasn't as obvious back then when there was a much stricter idea of a separation between the body and the soul, right? He even says, quote, "Psychological pain may lead to bodily illness," which we know, of course, is true. In any case, after a short introduction, he then goes into categorizing and listing the main mental and psychological ailments, which are anger, fear, and panic. So panic would be like the extreme form of fear, depression and sadness, and what is essentially OCD, or like intrusive thoughts, obsessive thinking. Obsessive compulsive disorder, essentially. He calls it whisperings from the Quran, but it's very clear that this is what it means. Interesting, he seems to argue that all these mental ailments, the negative ones, have as their sort of root anxiety, what he calls in Arabic al-gham, that even anger only arises after first anxiety over a situation arises, and then that turns into anxiety. That turns into anger. And that this is the case for all the different things. Even depression comes from anxiety first, and then it turns into depression or sadness. So that, like, anxiety is some kind of base, core reason for all these other things. Whether you agree with this theory or not, it's up to you. And I think what we would call anxiety, many aspects of anxiety today, at least, would probably fall into the sort of fear and panic part of what he's talking about. So it might be a bit of a different way of categorizing things than we do today. But still, what he then does is that he goes into trying to give advice on all these different things, how to alleviate them, how to treat them in different ways. And this is the main section of the book. Obviously, we can't go through all of it because it's quite a short work, but still, there's a lot there to go through. But what I would recommend is you going out and actually reading it, because it's quite short, and there's an English translation by Malik Bedri that I recommend. What we can do is really look at some of the most interesting parts, especially from a modern therapeutic perspective, where he seems to be saying things that are very much ahead of his time and that are still relevant today for mental health and mental health treatment. First of all, we can begin with a section on depression, where he seems to anticipate discoveries that wouldn't become the norm for 1,000 years after, at least as far as I know. There could be other examples, of course, but what I mean by that is that he seems to understand and categorize depression itself into two different essential kinds. There's one depression that is a reactionary response to something happening in your life, right? Someone dies or you lose your job or something, and that makes you depressed, which is very, it's a natural reaction, a natural response to something happening. This is the way we should work, ideally. But then there's another kind of depression that doesn't really have any clear cause. He says, we begin by stating that sadness or depression is of two distinct types. The first type is the one that has a clear identifiable cause, such as the death of a beloved relative, or the loss of wealth, or something that the person greatly values. The second type has no obvious cause. It's a sudden distress and gloom that descends over the afflicted person, preventing him, most of the time, from exuberance of activity and the enjoyment of the usual pleasures of this world. The person afflicted is generally unaware of any clear reason for his dejection. This is really interesting. The first kind of depression and sadness basically all of us experience. Life is such that things don't always go our way, and there will inevitably be things that happen that are very distressing to us, such as what he mentioned, that a loved one dies, right? It's a natural thing to become depressed in such a situation, as it is a direct response to external events. But the second kind is different, but it's still something that a lot of people struggle with. This is a very common thing, where depression can just descend upon us without any clear reason behind it, but still render us completely unable to get out of bed or do anything. We can't motivate ourselves to do anything, and we also can't seem to find any reason why we feel this way. And for many, this might even be a recurring thing throughout their life, not just something that happens once or twice, but is a recurring thing. In other words, it seems that al-Belkhi has discovered what we refer to today as clinical depression or major depressive disorder. We know that depression doesn't have to have an external cause, but can be the result of a combination of different causes, including genetic, biological, and chemical imbalance in the brain. Physical, biological causes, in other words, rather than being simply a reaction to external events. Many people today still don't know that this is a thing and will experience a lot of guilt or helplessness because they think that depression must have a cause in the standard way, but they can't seem to figure out what that cause is. But this is a very common thing that many people experience, and it can even become for some a kind of chronic depression, where this is a lifelong thing and it's simply the way that their brain works, right? So what's the solution to this? Well, Abizaid goes on to also highlight this aspect of it, that it has physical, biological causes, and also suggests certain treatments. He says, quote, the causes behind the latter type of sadness or depression for which there is no known reason are related to bodily symptoms, such as the impurity of the blood, its coolness, and the changes in its content. The treatment for this symptom is physical and psychological. As for the physical, it concentrates on purifying the blood, increasing its temperature, and making it lighter. The psychological is limited to gentle, encouraging talk that brings back some happiness, as well as listening to music and songs and similar activities that emotionally give warmth to the gloomy. Obviously, he doesn't get the science right here, as he's still relying on old, incorrect Galenic medicine. So all this talk about the impurity of the blood is very outdated and wrong, but he was onto the right idea, specifically that the causes can be bodily, and importantly, the treatment of this kind of depression is both physical and psychological. Just as today we know that people suffering from clinical depression will often require both therapy and medication for the best treatment. And this is in fact a recurring theme in the text, the general idea that there are both external and internal ways of treating all these different ailments. Just as in the previous part of the book where he described bodily sickness, the first part, there are external and internal ways of treating it too. External might be going to a doctor and get some medicine, internal might be to change your diet to one that is more beneficial, for example. The external method that he mentions the most when it comes to mental illness is the one that he touched on briefly in that last quote as the psychological one. gentle encouragement, or as he explains in another part of the text, conversation with a trusted friend or loved one that can help with advice. What he is essentially doing here, in his own way, is arguing for therapy, or talk therapy specifically. Quote, externally, one can listen to the advice of another whose therapeutic discussion or counseling would calm the agitated soul and treat its abnormality. I also love this section where he explains why it is more beneficial to talk to someone else rather than to rely on yourself in these kinds of situations. Quote, additionally, we see that just as in treating bodily illness, the external help one receives from therapeutic diets or a physician's prescription is more useful than a person's own internal treatment, such as preventing consumption of certain foods, so it is with respect to psychological disorders. That is, the benefit one obtains externally from advice and counseling is more useful than a person's internal thoughts. This is due to two reasons. First, man in general accepts from others what he does not accept from himself. His reasoning and thought are intermixed with his passions, each implicated by the other. Second, one suffering painful psychological symptoms is so occupied and overpowered by them that he cannot clearly think how to overcome them. He needs others to show him the way to recovery. I think we can all agree that there's a certain level of truth to what he's saying here, right? We often listen much more when someone else tells us what to do rather than to sort of try to give advice to ourselves. And he gives very good arguments for why this is. So this is the external method that he mentions the most, perhaps, which essentially boils down to what we call therapy today. And as for the internal method, he gives different ones, and we'll go through some of them soon, but one of them is that he says that we should, when we're in a positive state, so when we're not feeling bad, we should save positive thoughts, like put them in our pockets, metaphorically, of course, so that then later on, when we feel bad, then we can take those positive thoughts out that we've saved, and that will help, you know, help us feel better, basically. I'm sure that can help for certain situations, but it's, you know, it's quite a limited treatment, but it's one of the ones that he gives here. But there's another really interesting aspect of his treatment advice that he gives, at least the most full explanation he gives in this section on fear and panic. And I think what we might include in that category, in terms of our modern categories, is also many forms of anxiety and, you know, general anxiety disorder, for example, would probably fit into this section on fear and panic. And what he does, the advice that he gives, is essentially, or almost exactly, what we know today as cognitive behavioral therapy, or CBT, and specifically the main method of that form of therapy, which is exposure therapy. So cognitive behavioral therapy is a relatively new form of therapy that has a very different approach to something like psychoanalysis, right? So it does not seek to find some sort of root trauma or something that is the cause of behavior. Rather, it's looking at the symptoms themselves and the behavioral patterns that people find themselves in, the kind of self-talk, the kind of behaviors that we do to alleviate uncomfortable situations and discomfort, and see that as the main issue, and then work on practical methods to help rewire the brain. I'm bastardizing and giving a very basic rundown here, but to rewire the brain by countering these behaviors, these routines, or these things that we do that are detrimental, that make us worse, right? And the main method, I would argue, in CBT is something known as exposure therapy. And this is the idea that we are to expose ourselves to uncomfortable thoughts, uncomfortable situations, things that we are afraid of. Because what the pattern usually is that we have a thought that might be scary, that might be very uncomfortable, and then, you know, that makes us uncomfortable, that makes us feel anxious, it makes us feel anxiety. What we do then is we do certain behaviors to try to alleviate that. We try to make that fear go away. We try to make sure that fear won't happen. For example, if we are afraid of, say, elevators, we have a phobia of going into elevators. We think that something's going to happen. That gives an emotional response. We're afraid. And then we avoid the elevator. But what that is doing is that it's reaffirming that fear. Because by avoiding the elevator, you're telling your brain that indeed the elevator is dangerous. And so that will only create this loop that's making things worse. And so what exposure therapy does, of course, under controlled circumstances, is to force you to break that behavior. So you have a thought, you feel anxious or fear, but then you don't do the behavior that makes you feel safe. And you might even go against it. So you might even have to go into the elevator. You have to ride the elevator, maybe just one stop, and then you'll do it a couple of times, then two stops. And then what that does is that it teaches your brain. It teaches you that it's actually not dangerous. And so by breaking that pattern, you're freeing yourself from that loop, and that will help you heal, right? And you can do this with all kinds of different fears. So this is exposure therapy and the very sort of core of CBT. And what we get in Al-Belkhi's section on treating fear or anxiety is essentially the exact same. This is what he says, quote, "One of these tactics is for the frightened person to realize that in most cases, the fear created by the expectation of a threatening experience is much greater than the real experience itself, if it actually occurs. This is because most of what man is afraid of is not really harmful as he expects. For this reason, some scholars have likened the things that frighten people to a thick ground fog in a cold country. An uninformed person, like an Arab Bedouin living in a hot desert, would think it to be a solid black object without any outlets and that it can trap people inside it. However, if daring to enter, he would find it to be simply moist air that he can breathe." He then goes on to explain that the person who wants to conquer or get rid of this kind of fear or anxiety should expose themselves to that fear again and again until they become accustomed to it and the fear will go away. This is a much longer section, of course, but he summarizes in the end quite nicely. Quote, "From this, we conclude that the best methods for tranquilizing fear and panic are to acquire much knowledge and information of fearsome things, to discover that they are not really harmful, and to force oneself to repeatedly expose one's hearing and sight to noxious things, though disliking the practice, until one's senses are familiarized by them. In tolerating the pain of this exercise, one is in fact training oneself like the riding of an animal forced by the whip to move again and again near the thing that it is scared of until it becomes used to it and loses its fear." This description could be used almost word for word in a modern CBT manual for exposure therapy. It's quite remarkable that Al-Belkhi wrote these things so long ago. Of course, we do have precursors to this kind of approach with the Stoics, for example, who are indeed a major inspiration behind the development of CBT in general. But I don't think I've ever seen something so clearly express the very essence of this form of therapy from a pre-modern source. But on a personal level, I am perhaps especially fascinated by the last section of the work, dedicated to obsessive and intrusive thoughts. Al-Belkhi uses Quranic language here by referring to this as waswasa, meaning whisperings, or the whisperings of the soul, which is referred to in places like Surat An-Nas, where the devil is described as the one who whispers into the hearts of men. But Abu Zaid's description is no simple theistic or supernatural explanation, but rather seems to, in a very wise and nuanced way, describe obsessive compulsive disorder, also known as OCD. Now, this term is used quite liberally today by people for just someone who likes to have their things tidy in their house or something, but is a very real and serious mental handicap that can be incredibly debilitating for some people. The most famous kind of OCD is the one that takes an external manifestation, such as a person having to repeat an action many times before feeling safe to move on, like, for example, excessively washing your hands again and again or locking the door multiple times. But OCD can also be purely internal and mental, where the person gets stuck in mental spirals, often accompanied by very strong, intense feelings of anxiety, creating a vicious circle. This internal OCD is also known as pure O OCD. And as a person who struggles with OCD myself, particularly the latter kind, I'm kind of convinced that Abu Zaid has some personal experience of this condition, based on the fact that he describes it with such presence and nuance in a way that I don't really see many people, especially in pre-modern times, but even today, many people wouldn't describe it this accurately. And I think it's also kind of corroborated, this is me speculating, but I feel like it's corroborated by this idea that he was reserved and shy in his life. Right? It seems like he maybe had some struggles with his mental health sometimes. And this is my theory, right? That this is why he is so good at describing these things, because he might have had personal experience. Anyway, this is how he describes these whispers or these compulsive thoughts. Quote, "The fourth psychological symptom or disorder is obsession. Its persistence in the human heart or mind causes repetitive, repulsive, or immoral thoughts that result in apprehension and unhappiness to the extent that the one obsessed may lose his ability to enjoy the pleasures of the body and the soul." Just like in the description on depression, al-Balkhi also notes that this is something that does not just have external factors, but is something that can be physical, like biological and genetic, that this is, for some people, this is just how they are born and how their brain works, essentially. He says that, of course, everyone has uncomfortable, intrusive thoughts. You know, this is very natural. We all have these thoughts that are uncomfortable sometimes, that we don't want. But some people are unable to stop ruminating to the point that it, quote, interferes with everyday chores and becomes strongly debilitating. There's one section here that I find especially profound, which is one where he seems to try to describe an aspect of OCD that's very hard to describe to someone who doesn't experience it, which is this sensation that you feel this fear over something, you have an obsessive thought over a fear that might be completely irrational. Like, never in a million years would this actually happen, and it's very far off. But the more you ruminate, and the higher the anxiety level becomes, that creates the sensation of that thing being very likely to happen. Maybe not to your rational brain, but to your nervous system, right? This is about to happen, or maybe even this has already happened, and you feel the guilt of it already having happened, right? So it's a very strange thing that happens, very irrational kind of thing, but very real. And this is how he describes it. "As the symptom intensifies, the sickened soul would give the person afflicted a strong feeling of the distant event in space and time being imminent or about to happen. When this sad state takes its toll, the person would find himself unable to use his mental faculties or deal with anything else, and would be too busy with the imagined imminent danger to enjoy any pleasures or to concentrate on what is said to him or to socialize with others. Whenever he tries to let go and socialize, the disturbing thoughts will shoot up to control his mind. This would leave him a victim of his own negative, dreadful thinking and agitating inner talk. This miserable condition is comparable to one who is continuously subjected to horrible nightmares from which he awakens in a terrible state of fear and anxiety. These recurring frightening dreams occur to some people during the night, while the nightmarish thoughts of the one afflicted with this symptom of self-talk possess him during the day. The sufferer imagines impending danger and threatening occurrences in his wakeful inner whispers, while the dreamer sees these frightening incidents in his sleep. However, they are both caused by internal self-talk." For anyone who has OCD, I think this description hits quite close to home, and it's really remarkable that this is written in the 9th century. He explains that this condition can be very debilitating mentally, but could also cause physical illness, just like all these other mental afflictions. And so it's very pertinent that we try to treat it if we're suffering from this. So how does he think we should treat these particular intrusive thoughts, these obsessions? Well, he points to earlier treatment methods that we've already talked about as being relevant here as well. Counseling or therapy, saving positive thoughts to be brought out later, and to expose oneself to fearful things. Of course, today we know that one of the most effective treatments of OCD is also CBT and exposure therapy. Because the obsessive thoughts are often accompanied by fear and anxiety, we obsess over certain thoughts precisely because they are perceived as dangerous. So just as we can expose ourselves to situations that are perceived to be dangerous and build resistance to them, so to say, we can also expose ourselves to uncomfortable thoughts, which will cause them to weaken due to a decrease in the sense of danger associated with them. Al-Balkhi seems to have known this, even if he doesn't mention it specifically as a treatment for OCD here. But he also gives us what might be seen as a very simple, but still very practical and actually useful advice, which is, don't be alone too much. Instead, hang out with people you enjoy. be social, converse with people, maybe even about your obsessive thoughts. This will help you out of that loop and to enjoy things more. You can even listen to music or be intimate with your partner, all things that help bring your mind to other things. If you're alone with your thoughts, then they will start creeping up on you. Secondly, you should have a job or a profession, or at least occupy yourself with things, which will alleviate the obsessive thoughts since there's little room for them. Again, this might seem simple, and of course just avoiding things like this doesn't really work if there's a deeper problem at work, but sometimes it actually is that simple. If you do things you enjoy despite the thoughts and anxiety being there, that helps rewire your brain to realize that they aren't dangerous and that will help you healing. Because a lot of the anxiety that people feel in these kinds of situations revolve around the idea that, you know, your life is over, you can't enjoy things, like you want to go back to the way things were. So if you can still go do the things that you enjoy, despite feeling bad, despite having the anxiety, you know, the more you do that, the more you realize that you still can enjoy things. And that will also help alleviate some of that anxiety and that fear that the anxiety itself has ruined your life, essentially. You know what I mean? So there's a lot more to this advice than it might seem at first glance. It might seem very simple, but this is actually quite helpful as well. Now, being a devout Muslim, he then also naturally turns to some theistic strategies, such as trusting in God and his plan and accepting that which God has put upon you as part of your development. But for the non-theists and atheists out there, you don't have to dismiss these arguments entirely. Indeed, we might be able to take God out of it, and it still kind of works, because the argument is essentially one of acceptance. You accept that life is full of both pleasure and pain, and that acceptance and lack of resistance can be a way to better handle and alleviate the symptoms, since the cause of the anxiety itself often comes from resistance and an attempt to control one's thoughts and feelings, which isn't really possible most of the time. And in the same section, he comes to a powerful conclusion about this acceptance, but specifically acceptance of the fact that you suffer from OCD, that this is simply how your brain works, and that we have to learn how to live with it. But knowing what the cause of the thoughts and anxieties are, in this case a diagnosis, can be immensely comforting and a huge help in allowing us to better handle when an obsession grips us. Knowing that it has a cause, has happened before, that there is nothing to fear, and that it will pass. Quote, "An additional useful thought is to deliberate on the problem and its causes. Doing so, the sufferer would come to the conclusion that his symptom, despite its persistent pains and worries, was actually rooted in his natural disposition and temperament. He should then convince himself that any predisposed psychological disorder should not cause him to be disturbed or scared, since he knows of its origin and accordingly expects its occurrence. In this, he should be like the one suffering from a chronic physical bodily complaint. Such a person quickly learns to live with it and familiarizes himself with its pains. In fact, there are very few people indeed who do not complain of a physical disorder that afflicts them because of their natural predisposition and inherited temperament. The fact that these physical symptoms continue for a long time would help them to accustom themselves to them. Also, such a person will come to realize that his negative whispers would not endanger his life or cause him to suffer incapacitating disease, allowing him to tolerate and live happily with them. The fact that they are afflicting him because of his inherited predisposition, his inability to change, would further support him in tolerating them." There is, of course, more we could talk about, but then I would just be reading you the whole book. So we're going to stop here. But I hope that just based on what we've been talking about so far, that you'll agree that this is a quite remarkable text for its time. And that Abu Sa'id al-Balkhi seems to be centuries ahead of his own time. And for that reason, I think he deserves to be known more widely in the world and to be firmly placed in the intellectual history of medicine and health, both physical and especially mental health. I mean, even most people today don't even talk about these things with such nuance and understanding that he did 1,000 years ago. It was the Turkish scholar Fuat Sezgin who discovered the work, or rather who discovered how significant it was in its approach, and this has helped bring it to light, at least in certain academic circles. There is an English translation of the work by Malik Badri, which I have relied on completely for this video, both the translation and the historical analysis that's attached to it. So I want to expend a special shout out of gratitude to the actual scholars of whom I am just reporting, right? I'm just a reporter that's telling you what other actual scholars have done. So I'm relying completely on these scholars. And if you want to read the work, it's quite a short work. It's very easy to read. And it is available in English translation by Malik Badri, which I highly recommend. And hopefully this will lead to Abu Zayd al-Balkhi being more widely known globally, and that he can be seen as another one of the great geniuses from the classical Islamic world. Thank you so much for listening and for watching. As you can tell, I'm not 100% healthy myself right now. I'm struggling with a bit of a cold, so my voice isn't as healthy as it usually is. I hope it wasn't unpleasant to listen to. Thank you for watching for this past year, 2025. This will be coming out early 2026. So I just want to say thank you here for a wonderful year. Thank you for the million subscribers. That's amazing. Special thank you to my patrons, as always, on patreon.com, who support me monetarily, without whom none of this would be possible. So thank you so much. If you want to become a patron and support me, then there's links in the link tree in the description to all of that, both the Patreon and the PayPal one-time donation that you can also make. You can also support just by leaving a like, commenting, or subscribing to the channel. It's all very helpful. If you're interested in me and my work, then you can find me on my socials on Instagram and TikTok, for example. It's on the screen here. It's also on the screen in the beginning of every video. And you can also check out my other channel, Philip Holm, which is dedicated to my music, both my own music and posting about music, just like I talk about religion here. So if that's interesting, go subscribe there. I have a new single coming out pretty soon, in the beginning of February. So you'll know more about that soon. But thank you again so much for listening and watching, and I will see you next time.